one's thinking, even men who were otherwise open-minded. Our mutual friend might have properties around town that I can borrow. Since he seems to have given Sherlock Holmes a condition, it would be doable to tell the inspector that Sherlock Holmes is in the next room, but cannot receive him in person, and that I, Miss Holmes, must be the conduit through which information passes. If she started preparing this very moment, and everything went her way, she should be able to pull off the meeting, if only just. May I have some time to make the arrangements, Mrs. Watson? Of course, you must deduct.
I have a better idea, said Mrs. Watson. I have some properties on Upper Baker Street, right behind the house. One of my tenants moved out 2 weeks ago. The flat has been cleaned and made ready, but not yet put up for let again. What do you say that you receive your inspector right there?
Charlotte did not debate long with herself. In that case, would you mind asking Mr. Lawson to stop at the nearest post office? I'd like to send a cable to the inspector and ask him to meet me tonight. Charlotte had accepted Mrs. Watson's offer because she needed it. Time was of the essence. But as they went about staging the flat on Upper Baker Street, she saw that she'd have done Mrs. Watson a disservice if she'd declined her help. Mrs. Watson had come alive. The flat was already furnished, but she immediately set to work to make it look lived in. Potted plants and plump seat cushions were hauled over from her own house. Books by the gross went on the shelves. Several days' worth of newspapers and half a dozen magazines were stuffed into a canterbury next to the fireplace. But Mrs. Watson was far from finished. They needed to create the illusion that a man lived on the premises. She set a decanter of whiskey on the sideboard, hung hats and a pair of men's coats, and planted three walking sticks into the umbrella stand by the door. A tobacco pipe was lit and left to smoulder in an ashtray. Cups of steaming tea were allowed to sit and cool for their fragrance to diffuse. And then, in a moment of inspired attention to detail, she simmered water over a spirit lamp and added a few drops each of cough syrup, camphor, and linseed oil, along with a handful of dried herbs. Immediately the flat took on the smell of convalescence, of many tinctures and compounds poured out and administered to a loved one. She walked about the parlour, checking it from various angles, her brow furrowed. Charlotte, who had been placing a few of her own books onto the shelves, followed her line of sight. Knick-knacks and souvenirs populated the top of the shelves. A vase of roses sat on the seat of the bow window that looked down onto Upper Baker Street. In the adjacent bedroom, a bolster had been placed under the cover of the fully made-up bed. The pair of men's slippers peeking out from beneath the bedstead served as the perfect detail for someone stealing a glance into the room with the door open a bare inch.
"No photographs," said Charlotte.
"I knew it," exclaimed Mrs. Watson. "I knew something was missing. Would you happen to have any?"
"A few." She had brought a small album with her. "But none of them show me with anyone who can pass for a brother."
"Good enough. We'll say Sherlock Holmes has an aversion to cameras."
They adjourned to Mrs. Watson's house for a late tea. Afterward, Charlotte went to her room to fetch the photographs. But as she returned to the corridor, she nearly bumped into Mrs. Watson, whose expression immediately made her ask,
"What's the matter, ma'am?"
"I hate to tell you this, Miss Holmes, but I just learned that your father quarrelled with Lady Amelia the evening before she died. A bad quarrel. And he was heard to make threats on her life."
12. Lord Ingram stood on the curb, studying the solidly constructed red brick edifice with a singular concentration. Unlike Inspector Treddles, his lordship didn't seem to approve of the place.
But more surprisingly, Treddles could not detect any trace of gladness in his lordship's countenance. Treddles, on the other hand, had leaped from his desk upon the arrival of Holmes's cable, gasping with marvel. "Mr. Sherlock Holmes will be delighted to receive you at 7 tonight and discuss the Sackville case, 18 Upper Baker Street." Taking advantage of Scotland Yard's telephonic systems, he had immediately rung Lord Ingram. His lordship was not at home, but a message had come for Treddles not long after. Lord Ingram had heard from Holmes and would meet Inspector Treddles at 18 Upper Baker Street this evening. The two men shook hands.
"My lord, you seem more concerned than pleased. But Holmes's recovery is terrific news, is it not?"
"I'm afraid the news is less optimistic than you believe, Inspector."
"So he hasn't recovered?"
Lord Ingram exhaled.
"Not by any standards you and I would consider recovered."
"Then
we'll know more inside."
They rang the bell. Treddles held his breath. Despite Lord Ingram's less than sanguine words, he remained excited at the possibility of meeting the great Sherlock Holmes. A large, stooped woman in a starched white cap answered the door. She peered up at them through a pair of wire-rimmed glasses perched at the tip of her nose and said in a broad Yorkshire accent,
"You'll be the gentleman Miss Holmes is waiting for. Come in, then."
"Miss Holmes?"
Inspector Treddles mouthed to Lord Ingram as they followed the woman's plentiful behind up the stairs.
"The sister,"
Lord Ingram answered. This surprised Treddles. Of course, Holmes was at liberty to have any number of sisters, but Treddles had always envisioned him as a solitary creature, not someone who shared a house with female relations. They were brought into a cosy-looking parlour, with rose and ivy wallpaper, chintz-covered chairs, and a grandfather clock ticking away quietly in the corner. Miss Holmes, who had been standing before the window looking out, turned around at their entrance. Treddles's eyes widened. He had not expected Holmes's sister to resemble an advertising illustrator's idea of ideal femininity. He glanced at Lord Ingram. The latter appeared unmoved. But of course, he would have met Miss Holmes before, since he was acquainted with the latter's brother. Miss Holmes came forward and shook hands with her callers.
"Good evening, my lord. Good evening, Inspector. A pleasure to make your acquaintance."
"Likewise," said Treddles. "I'd have dearly wished for us to meet under happier circumstances, but I'm nevertheless encouraged that Mr. Holmes is well enough to be consulted."
Miss Holmes sat down and folded her hands in her lap.
"My brother's health has long been a burden to him. This latest episode was the most terrible yet. We truly lost hope at one point. Even at the moment he is barely able to communicate."
"Still, thank goodness."
"Yes, it's truly a miracle that he has recovered as much as he has," said Miss Holmes with feeling. "Unfortunately, he is bedridden, and therefore not able to receive you in person."
"Oh."
Treddles hoped his disappointment didn't show too plainly.
"Then he will not be able to discuss the case with us."
"While Sherlock will not be able to discuss the case, he will most certainly be able to contribute. We have rigged this room in a discreet manner so that he can see and hear everything from his sickbed."
The woman who had opened the door for Treddles and Lord Ingram returned, carrying a tray of tea. Miss Holmes poured a cup and handed it to her.
"Will you take this to my brother, Mrs. Hudson? And will you stay with him to make sure he's comfortable?"
"Yes, miss," said Mrs. Hudson.
She waddled off with the cup of tea. Lord Ingram stared after her, a strange grimace on his face.
Miss Holmes poured for the rest of them and passed around a plate of curious-looking biscuits, fluted like seashells.
"Madeleine," she said, "they are very good. The recipe is said to come from Madame Durant herself."
Treadles had no idea who Madame Durant was, but the biscuits were indeed good. In fact, by his third bite, he realized they were spectacularly delicious. He looked down at the plate and wondered whether it would be possible to pilfer one undetected to take home to Alice.
"I understand time is short," said Miss Holmes. "We are ready to proceed whenever you care to start, Inspector."
Treadles glanced toward the room that held the individual.
"You are certain, Miss Holmes, that this arrangement will prevail?"
"I have no doubt."
"But Mr. Holmes, if he is as indisposed as I imagine him to be, what if our discussion should prove too taxing? Out here I would not know when to stop."
"Mrs. Hudson would let us know if we have gone on too long for him."
Treadles lowered his voice, though he had the impression he was only being silly rather than discreet.
"I hate to ask this, Miss Holmes, but the episode, has it affected your brother's mind?"
Miss Holmes smiled. Was it an ironic smile?
"Allow me to assure you, Inspector, that although the episode negatively affected many aspects of Sherlock Holmes's life, it mercifully spared his mind, which remains as eccentric and intractable as ever."
Was Treadles imagining things? Or did Lord Ingram let out an almost inaudible snort?
"You are still unsure, Inspector," said Miss Holmes. "Would you like to know for certain that Sherlock's powers of observation and deduction are very much intact?"
"I would take the lady at her word," said Lord Ingram as he studied the rim of his teacup.
It occurred to Treadles that his lordship hadn't looked directly at Miss Holmes since they arrived.
"The choice is yours, Inspector," said Miss Holmes.
Treadles hesitated some more.
"My lord, have you seen Miss Holmes's brother face to face since his episode?" "No, I have not." "Then with all due apology, as this is a matter of public trust, I would like to be assured that Mr. Holmes's capabilities are what they were."
"Of course," said Lord Ingram. Oddly enough, his lordship's voice contained no trace of annoyance, only the faintest hint of pity.
"If you'll excuse me for a moment."
Miss Holmes went into the next room and closed the door. Treadles turned to Lord Ingram.
"My lord, I hope I have not given offence in following my own counsel." "Not at all. Were I you, I would have made the same choice."
Treadles exhaled, but then Lord Ingram added,
"And were you me, you'd have issued the same warning."
Miss Holmes returned with a bright smile for her visitors. She took her seat and arranged her skirts with practiced ease.
"This is what Sherlock has to say about you, Inspector."
"Him?"
Treadles glanced again at Lord Ingram, who seemed once again fascinated by the shape of his teacup. Miss Holmes pulled out a small notebook from a pocket in her skirt and consulted it.
"You come from the northwest, Cumbria, Barrow-in-Furness. Your father was employed by either the steelworks or the shipyard. The shipyard, most likely. He was Scottish, your mother wasn't. He did well enough to send you to a good school, but unfortunately he died young, and you weren't able to go to university."
Treadles stared at her. Had Sherlock Holmes learned all this from Lord Ingram? But he couldn't remember ever telling his lordship what Angus Treadles had done for a living.
"You began your career in Cumbria, but came to London before too long. Here you were married, a happy union, many congratulations. Your father-in-law was a well-to-do man, and like Lord Ingram, He appreciated your intelligence, industry, and decency. Unfortunately, he is no more, and his heir, who is not a man of as exceptional caliber, does not feel nearly the same affection toward either you or your wife. Finances have become strained, but your wife is a resourceful and resilient woman, and your domestic contentment has not been adversely affected. Inspector Treddles, with some effort, closed his mouth. He was sure he had never mentioned his finances to Lord Ingram, who now wore an expression of mild apology. "Mr. Holmes knows all this, from having listened to me speak 10 words.
You have spoken closer to 100 words, far more than necessary to pinpoint your general place of origin and your level of education, although in your case it is a bit more complicated, with the trace of Scottish brogue in your vowels, which on the other hand made it easier to conclude Barrow in Furness, with its large Scottish population attracted by work in the industries. As for whether it is the steelworks or the shipyard, your own expression gave away the correct answer. The rest is fairly obvious. You're still a young man. To have risen to your current position indicates that you started early, but also possess a drive to succeed. Yet you are not one of those men for whom ambition is everything, or Lord Ingram wouldn't have taken any interest in your concerns. She cast a look at Lord Ingram, who stirred his tea with great concentration.
"Indeed not," said he.
Even in the midst of his own astonishment, Inspector Treddles was beginning to wonder at the nature of the association between Lord Ingram and the Holmeses, between his lordship and Miss Holmes especially. Miss Holmes smiled again.
"Does that answer your question?"
Treddles had to think for a moment to remember what his question had been. How Holmes could know so much about him from so little?
"Not entirely."
"Ah, your domestic situation. It is infinitely more likely that you left Barrow in Furness before you were married than after. You appear too prudent a man to marry early, and of course it is far easier to relocate as a bachelor than with a family in tow. As for your late father-in-law's comfortable circumstances, the fabric and cut of your garments indicate that they were made by a tailor whose work Lord Ingram's valet would not have disdained. In other words, your late father-in-law's tailor. But for all that exquisite material and equally exquisite workmanship, your clothes are 2 years behind fashion. The buttons have been recently replaced, and the cuffs rewoven. Perhaps most tellingly, your shirt has a detachable collar. Lord Ingram, does your shirt have a detachable collar?"
"No," said his lordship. "It does not."
"Lord Ingram has no need of detachable collars because he can afford to launder dozens of entire shirts at a go. But a man who wears a detachable collar underneath a jacket made by one of London's finest tailors, either he stole the jacket or his circumstances have been reduced. Since wages at the Metropolitan Police Force have not suffered a noticeable decline, one can only conclude that Mrs. Treddles's income had been drastically cut, and it seems reasonable to conclude that instead of a generous father, she now has a much less generous brother. With regard to her devotion to you, she is being punished for marrying down by that ghastly brother of hers, and yet you look impeccable. The care and skill that went into the repair of your garments nearly equals that which went into their creation. Whatever sacrifices she has had to make in the running of the household, she has made sure that they affect you as little as possible. If that is not love..." Throughout her explanations, Inspector Treddles had to restrain his facial muscles from expressions of dismay and stupefaction. To have his domestic situation laid bare like this by a stranger, and before an esteemed friend, no less. But now he found himself fighting back unexpected tears.
"I am extraordinarily fortunate in Mrs. Treddles,"
"Yes, you are, Inspector," said Miss Holmes, taking a sip of her tea. Inspector Treddles did the same, to help recover from his sudden onset of sentiments.
"Dear Alice. Dear, dear Alice."
"Well, Inspector, do you feel more confident now that my brother's abilities have not been diminished by his recent misfortune?"
Treddles wasn't sure whether confident was the correct word. He was awed, as well as rattled.
Yes, Miss Holmes."
She smiled again.
"Excellent. Let us proceed."
Treddles gave a quick account of his investigation thus far.
"After I left Lord Sheridan's residence, I happened to run into Lord Ingram. Taking advantage of that, I requested his help in finding out what lay behind the estrangement between the brothers. It took me a little longer to hunt down my quarry than I'd anticipated," said Lord Ingram. "When I received word that you had telephoned, Inspector, I had just spoken to Lady Avery."
"Lady Avery, of course," said Miss Holmes. She turned to Treddles. "Lady Avery and her sister Lady Summersby are society's most accomplished gossips. They possess an encyclopedic knowledge of every affair, every snub, and every spat from the past 50 years. If anyone alive knows the reason for the estrangement, other than Lord Sheridan himself, it would be one of these ladies."
"Unfortunately, even Lady Avery has never been privy to the particulars of that alienation," said Lord Ingram. "She did, however, pinpoint the last time the brothers were seen together, which was in August of 59, 27 years ago. The previous summer, the Sheridans' only child had died. For a year afterward, the parents did not move in society. That August marked their first outing at a house party. Lady Avery was there in person and remembered the brothers being very affectionate. Later that year, she heard that Mr. Sackville had left for an extended stay in the south of France. She thought nothing of it. He was a wealthy bachelor, and south of France, a fashionable place. It was quite some time later that she noticed he had not returned. Then rumour had it that he did come back, but not to the bosom of the family. She tried to pry some information out of Lady Sheridan, but Lady Sheridan was apparently in the dark as well. She was under the impression that Mr. Sackville had suffered severe personal trials and was hurt that he didn't come to the family to seek comfort and succour, but rather shut himself away. Locations unknown. And that was all she was able to tell me. That and something that may or may not be related to the case. Inspector, you said you had verified that Lord Sheridan had been in town throughout the time period of interest. But did you ask about Lady Sheridan's movements?"
"No, I did not. It didn't occur to me."
"Lady Avery mentioned that she recently saw Lady Sheridan at Paddington Station getting off a train by herself without a maid in tow. She is sure that was the day Mr. Sackville died."
Paddington Station served all points west of London, including Devon. It would be very interesting if Lady Sheridan's travels had taken her to the vicinity of Stanwell Moot. But again, a tantalizing clue that did not amount to concrete evidence.
"Anything else, gentlemen?" asked Miss Holmes.
Inspector Treddles produced all the transcripts and reports that had been generated in the course of the investigation from the inquest onward.
"I will take this to my brother. Please excuse me."
They both rose as she departed. Lord Ingram remained on his feet and moved slowly about the room, examining the furnishing. Treddles, without thinking about it, reached for the notebook she had left behind. It was new, and almost completely blank, except a single word on the first page, "Barrow in Furness, his place of origin," written in an unfamiliar hand. He frowned and set the notebook down again. Lord Ingram was before the mantel, looking at framed photographs. his brow furrowed. Treadles moved to the bookshelf and picked up a slim volume lying on its side by none other than Lord Ingram himself, titled A Summer in Roman Ruins. Treadles remembered his lordship mentioning that he'd explored the remnants of a Roman villa on his uncle's estate. He didn't know Lord Ingram had also produced a written account. The book was dedicated to that wellspring of warmth and good sense, my friend and ally, J.H.R. The next page bore an inscription. To Holmes, long may you carry on as a reprobate of the First Order. Ash. Holmes dictated that inscription, said Lord Ingram from across the room. Treadles chuckled. He'd read only two pages when Miss Holmes said, a hint of mirth in her voice, Oh, the twists and turns in the plot of Lord Ingram's archaeological adventure. Treadles returned the book to its place. Mr. Holmes has read everything?
Yes.
And does he have any fresh insights? Asked Treadles, almost embarrassingly eager to receive what bounty of perspicuity Holmes might have to impart.
He noticed a discrepancy about the curtains in Mr. Sackville's room.
Oh?
Becky Birtle, the maid who first found Mr. Sackville in an unconscious state, said in her testimony at the inquest that she opened the curtains as soon as she went to Mr. Sackville's room. But in your interview with Mrs. Meek, the cook, she is recorded as saying that she and Mrs. Cornish, the housekeeper, opened the curtains after they reached the room to have a better look at Mr. Sackville. Treadles hoped his disappointment didn't show.
I noticed that as well, but I attributed it to the vagaries of memory. Witnesses almost always recollect the same events with noticeable differences. What does Mr. Holmes see as the significance of that discrepancy?
Miss Holmes glanced at Lord Ingram. With regard to the reconvening of the inquest tomorrow, nothing. It will be easily dismissed as vagaries of memory, as you said. Overall, Sherlock concurs with your assessment that there isn't enough evidence to persuade the coroner's jury to return a verdict that will allow you to carry on with the investigation.
This time, Treadles didn't bother to hide his dismay. Is there nothing we can do, then?
Miss Holmes tapped the tips of her fingers against one another. You can test the bottles of strychnine in Dr. Harris's and Dr. Birch's dispensaries.
Had he misheard? Strychnine? Mr. Sackville died of chloral.
We, however, are operating on the assumption that his death was not an accidental overdose, but a murder that is meant to appear as an accidental overdose.
Miss Holmes leaned forward an inch.
Were you the systematic executor who could pull off multiple murders that appear otherwise, Inspector? What would you have done ahead of time to make sure that Mr. Sackville wasn't saved by a dose of strychnine delivered just in time? It was the first time that anyone had, within Treadles's hearing, referred to the deaths of Mr. Sackville, Lady Amelia Drummond, and Lady Shrewsbury as murders. A chill ran down his spine.
Are you implying, Miss Holmes, that I would have tampered with the supply of strychnine in the vicinity?
Yes. So that even if help reached Mr. Sackville before the point of no return, that help would have been administered in vain.
Treadles let out a breath. That is both diabolical and brilliant.
It is, let's face it, quite a reach, said Miss Holmes modestly. But at this point, Inspector, what do you have to lose?
True, nothing. But I must make haste if I hope to achieve anything in time.
Cables needed to be sent immediately to have the evidence gathered for testing. He had planned to leave for Devon first thing in the morning, but now it would seem that he had better be on his way as soon as possible, to be there in the morning and urge matters along. He rose.
Thank you, Miss Holmes, and please convey my gratitude to Mr. Holmes. I will see myself out.
Inspector?
Yes, Miss Holmes. Miss Holmes smiled a little. My brother advises that you request the chemical analyst to also test Mr. Sackville for every poison for which he has an assay. If the strychnine turns out not to have been tampered with, then this will be our last hope, to find something in Mr. Sackville's system that couldn't have arrived there accidentally. 13. A silence fell at Inspector Treddles's departure. Charlotte moved to the window seat and poured a little water into the vase of roses. She was surprised to see raindrops rolling down the window panes. A shower fell, quiet and steady. A carriage passed below, hooves and wheels splashing, a yellow halo around each lantern. She had expected Lord Ingram to stay longer. They were friends of long standing, having known each other since they were children. She had very much looked forward to a word in private with him. But she forgot, as she usually did, the silence that always came between them in these latter years, whenever they found themselves alone. The sensation in her chest, however, was all too familiar. That mix of pleasure and pain, never one without the other. She could have done without those feelings. She would have happily gone her entire life, never experiencing the pangs of longing and the futility of regret. He made her human, or as human as she was capable of being, and being human was possibly her least favourite aspect of life. "More tea, sir?" she asked, remembering that they weren't truly alone. Mrs. Watson was in the next room, the door to which was open a crack.
"No, thank you," he said quietly.
"Nibbles?"
He hadn't touched the Madeleine. "Most kind of you, but no."
She returned to her seat and took a Madeleine herself. She didn't understand how anyone had the willpower to say no to Madeleine. Then again, the man before her said no to the vast majority of her suggestions, whether they concerned tea cakes or life-altering courses of action. Other young ladies she knew enjoyed the construction of an ideal man for themselves. Charlotte never understood the point of such an exercise. She'd yet to meet a woman who thought her house perfect. And unlike men, houses could be planned, expanded, and redecorated from top to bottom. But had she indulged in intellectually devising her own perfect match, she would have come up with someone substantially similar to herself. An aloof observer, a creature of silence, a man happy to live life entirely inside his own head. Whereas with Lord Ingram, she was always first struck by his physicality. She was aware of the space he occupied, his motion, his weight, the cut and drape of his coat, the length and texture of his hair, even though she had never touched his hair. She found herself observing intensely the direction of his gaze, the placement of his hands, the rise and fall of his chest with every breath. He was not the only fine male specimen of her acquaintance. Roger Shrewsbury, for one, was considered handsomer and more stylish. But Lord Ingram possessed something else, a vitality with a jolt of sensuality and an undercurrent of hostility to the world at large, which made for a masculinity magnetic to both men and women. When he was younger, that hostility had been more evident, but at some point, the troublemaker reformed and became thoroughly integrated with the rest of the upper 10,000. He was a member at all the expected clubs, friends with all the right people, and of course his polo matches featured as some of the more notable highlights of any given season. Another 10 years, and he'd be called a pillar of society. But somewhere beneath all the respectability and sociability still lurked the boy who preferred long solitary hours among relics to almost anything else. And he remained the only person she had ever met who did not mind her tendency toward silence. Sometimes she even thought he was at ease with it, though it was possible he was simply relieved that when she didn't speak, she couldn't make discomforting observations about his private life. She remembered Mrs. Watson again.
For her sake, the silence ought not to stretch much longer.
I didn't explain to Inspector Treddles what I thought to be the significance of the discrepancy concerning the curtains.
I noticed.
But you understood?
He hesitated briefly, then nodded.
It was Charlotte's estimation that when Inspector Treddles married a woman from a family far wealthier than his own, he consented to have his clothes made at one of the best tailors in London, to honour and respect his in-laws, so as to not appear as if he didn't belong. It was also her estimation that Mrs. Treddles, who married down, would have opted to run a simple household, leaving behind the more luxurious style she'd known, to honour and respect the man to whom she had made the commitment of a lifetime. Charlotte didn't believe Inspector Treddles's maid came into his bedchamber in the morning on a regular basis, and his inexperience in the matter caused him to miss the clue in Mrs. Meek's description of the events.
"I called on your sister this afternoon, by the way," said Lord Ingram.
Her fingers tightened around the half-eaten madeleine in her hand.
"How is she?"
"Doing her best to hold herself together."
"Oh, Livia."
"She knows about our father's quarrel with Lady Amelia?"
"Everybody knows."
Was there a more terrifying phrase in the English language than "unintended consequences"? "Did you see him?"
"He wasn't at home. And your mother was not receiving visitors."
"Meaning she had taken to her bed.
After another hefty dose of laudanum, no doubt. But Miss Livia did ask me to tell you, should I run into you, that she is grateful for what you have done. She emphasized that you couldn't possibly have foreseen that..."
"That by connecting the deaths of Lady Amelia, Lady Shrewsbury and Mr. Sackville, I would double the number of Holmeses suspected of homicide?"
"Inspector Treddles will find something tomorrow."
She almost dropped the madeleine in her surprise. He was consoling her, and he'd never consoled her in all the years they'd known each other.
"You don't believe it."
"I often question your actions, but rarely your reasoning, and this isn't one of those rare instances." She took a deep breath.
She had fallen so far that he, of all people, felt the need to comfort her.
"Thank you. Very kind of you."
Mrs. Watson stuck her head out from the bedroom.
"Beg your pardon, miss, but Mr. Holmes, he's fast asleep. Do you still need me to keep an eye on him?"
"That won't be necessary, Mrs. Hudson. Thank you."
Mrs. Watson bobbed a curtsy and left, galumphing down the stairs. When the house was quiet again, Lord Ingram asked,
"Is that the actress who took you in?"
His voice was carefully neutral, but nothing could disguise disapproval of this magnitude, so she pretended not to have heard it.
"She's very convincing, isn't she? And she's the one who identified the inspector's origin by his accent. I must have her train me to better hear the differences in regional accents."
"I don't like this arrangement. You know nothing about her."
At least now he was sounding more himself.
"I happen to think I know a great deal about her."
"That you can deduce someone's circumstances doesn't mean you can read all their thoughts and intentions. Ask yourself if this had happened to someone else, to Miss Livia, for example, wouldn't you point out that she is enjoying an unlikely amount of luck?"
"Sometimes luck is just luck."
"And most of the time, what seems too good to be true generally is."
"Disagreement. Their usual state of affairs. A bittersweet sensation, this familiarity. Sometimes it was more sweet than bitter, but not tonight."
She rose and walked to the desk at the back of the parlour.
"What would you have me do? Leave my benefactress?"
"Yes."
"And then what?"
"Let me help you," commanded her old friend, who had become so proper and decorous, every inch the future pillar of society. "You always said you wished to be the headmistress at a girls' school. You can still achieve that.
How?
He joined her at the side of the desk. Move to America. You can invent a new identity and start a new life there, with nothing to prevent you from going to school, receiving training, and ultimately finding a good position.
With you bearing all the expenditures in the meanwhile?
Pay me back, once you are self-supporting. With interest, if you'd prefer.
But there will be no consequences whatsoever if I do not or cannot pay you back. Am I correct?
He did not answer. The direction of his gaze, somewhere over her right shoulder, the placement of his hand, braced at the edge of the desk, the rise and fall of his chest with every breath, beneath his dark grey coat, his waistcoat was silk jacquard, silver tracery upon the blue of deepest twilight.
I assume you've heard from Mr. Shrewsbury?
His jaw tightened. I have.
Did he offer me the position of his mistress?
He did.
I hope you didn't decline on my behalf.
At last he looked directly into her eyes. I would not presume to speak for you. His dark eyes were solemn, almost antagonistic, yet heat prickled her skin and charred her nerves. She set the last bite of madeleine on her tongue.
Aren't you going to ask whether I will consider it?
His gaze dipped to her mouth before meeting hers again. I won't presume otherwise. You have demonstrated that you will consider and do just about anything. She tilted her chin up.
Are you angry with me?
He again did not answer, but looked at her as if taken aback at how close she was to him, even though they were separated by a chair.
I'm sure you would prefer for me to remain with Mrs. Watson, she murmured, rather than take up Mr. Shrewsbury's offer?
The direction of his gaze, the pulse at the base of her throat, the placement of his hand, a hard grip on the back of the chair. The fine white linen of his shirt rose and fell with every quickened breath. The next moment he was 10 feet away by the grandfather clock, standing with his back to her. And when have you ever taken my wishes into consideration when it comes to making your choices? She exhaled slowly, unsteadily.
I won't apologize, you know. Going to Mr. Shrewsbury was the only choice I could live with. The only way to break through this wall that my family would keep around me all my life.
Have I asked you to apologize?
No, but you are angry with me. Furious.
He turned around halfway. If glances could take physical form, he would have speared her to the wall. There isn't a single person with the slightest interest in your well-being who isn't furious with you, Charlotte.
But I'm fine now.
You are not starving in the streets, but you are not fine. You are a lady's companion, for God's sake. There is no one worse suited to being a lady's companion. Today you may rejoice in escaping worse misfortunes. Tomorrow too, perhaps. But in a week you will be bored out of your mind. When you were living under your parents' roof, at least you had the possibility of an independent future to look forward to. What do you have to look forward to now? Let me be generous and attribute only the best of motives to this Mrs. Watson. Still it remains that now you are an employee at a position that provides nothing of what you seek. No independence, no intellectual stimulation, and certainly not anywhere near £500 a year. How long can you last? How long before it sinks in that you have exchanged one cage for another? How long before your mind rebels against listening to the same anecdotes for the 58th time? She leaned against the desk, needing its support.
You make it sound so bleak.
What did you think it would be? A rich and fulfilling life?
This time it was she who did not answer.
He exhaled. I will see myself out.
He was retrieving his walking stick from the stand when she said, I will let you sponsor the cost of my emigration and education if you will agree to one condition.
No.
But you haven't...
He set a hand on the door.
I may not be able to tell what your mother had for lunch yesterday by the colour of your hat ribbons, but that doesn't mean I can't extrapolate what you are about to demand. It will be the same service you tried to extort from me by threatening to go to Roger Shrewsbury if I failed to provide it.
She slanted her lips.
You should have heeded that threat. We'd all be much better off if you'd come off your high horse and done some yeoman's work.
No, we'd all be much better off if you'd stuffed your idea exactly where I told you to.
I can't live the way you want me to. All bottled up and pretending that everything is all right.
It's how the rest of us live. Why can't you?
This debate was inching dangerously close to the lines of their previous conversation, which had flared into a heated argument and ended with her shouting that no, they really would have all been much better off if he'd taken her advice and never proposed to his wife. And I told you so, she had refrained from lobbing at him for 6 long years. They had not parted on the best of terms. She sighed.
Fine. Don't take me as your mistress then, even though you want to.
He set his hat on his head.
Good evening, Miss Holmes.
She hated it when he called her Miss Holmes in a private conversation, hated the distance it implied, the gulf that he would not cross.
I apologize for being such a trial when you are only trying to help. I'm sorry.
He was quiet for a long moment.
You don't try me, Charlotte. You discomfort me. You make me question things I would otherwise have happily accepted as given. But that is not your fault, not the preponderance of it anyway.
He opened the door and left. By the time she reached the stair landing, he was already halfway down.
Now I'm safe with Mrs. Watson, she called after him. You don't need to have me followed any more.
He stilled and answered without turning around.
Miss Holmes, I have no idea of what you speak.
Charlotte opened A Summer in Roman Ruins to her favourite page.
My aunt delighted in the entertainment of her progeny, and not infrequently hosted children's parties that were almost bacchanalian in their duration and intensity. The energy and volume of 2 dozen boys and girls did not bother me. I had been guilty of spurring them to ever greater levels of boisterousness. But that summer I slept fitfully, worried that one fine day a gaggle of youngsters with too much cake and orangeade in their bellies would break away from the vicinity of the house and stumble upon my wondrous and fragile sight. In fact, a reprobate 13-year-old preyed on my apprehension by threatening to do exactly that, drive a herd of wild children across the estate to descend upon my dig, wreaking as much havoc as Hannibal had done in Italy with troops and elephants brought across the Alps. What I had to do to preserve the integrity of my sight, I wish upon no one.
What memories! An excellent day's work, blackmailing his 15-year-old self into kissing her. I don't want a genteel peck, she'd told him cheerfully. I want you to live up to your scabrous reputation.
He'd scowled.
Do you even know what scabrous means?
Indecent and salacious.
That's the kind of reputation I have?
He was usually spoken of as that troublesome young Lord Ingram. And the other children whispered about him as if he had horns and a forked tail. He had been smoking cigarettes since he was 9. He had caused 12 governesses to be dismissed. He had got a serving maid into terrible trouble during his very first year at Eton. Charlotte didn't consider any of the rumours credible, except the smoking part. A hint of Turkish tobacco clung to him. Not an unpleasant scent for a glowering boy.
Yes, that's your reputation.
He looked at her askance.
And you want an indecent and salacious sort of kiss?
Is there any point to any other kind?
This last she might or might not have said out loud. The kiss that followed caused a minor malfunction in her brain. She didn't remember their exchanges afterward either, if anything at all. Present-day Charlotte sighed softly. They'd contemplated each other with so little regard. On the day they had first and last kissed, he as a target to exploit for her, and she as merely a very strange girl for him. If only they could have seen the future.
"Miss Holmes, you mustn't worry so much. Everything will be all right," said Mrs. Watson.
They were at the tail end of a late supper, and Charlotte was eating without her usual gusto. She sometimes thought of her mind as bearing a certain resemblance to the post office, a complex system that sorted and conveyed packets of information with speed and efficiency. But at the moment her most prized asset was more comparable to an automobile, a machine liable to break down every few miles and strand the hapless motorist by the side of the road. She smiled weakly at Mrs. Watson.
"I never used to fret about anything, and didn't understand why anyone would. If there was something that needed to be done, that was different. Worrying about outcomes over which I have no control is punishing myself before the universe has decided whether I ought to be punished. Now I realize that in my former life I worried about nothing because I feared nothing. That equanimity, which was but a false sense of security, evaporated the moment true consequences appeared. I was unnerved by what might happen to me, or my sister, and now my father."
She dipped her spoon into a bowl of fruit compote.
"You're right, Mrs. Watson. I mustn't worry so much, but at the moment I don't know how to stop."
"You are looking at me with hope, Miss Holmes," Mrs. Watson sighed. "It's all I know how to do, saying, 'You mustn't worry so much.' I haven't the slightest idea how to nip useless fretting in the bud. In fact, I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and worry, even though I am in circumstances that I would have considered enviable in my youth."
They fell silent for a time. It was still raining, the rain drumming steadily upon the roof. Charlotte speared a morsel of peach and pushed it around in the syrup.
"In any case, much uncertainty will be removed tomorrow. Inspector Treddles will let us know the moment he learns of anything."
Mrs. Watson likewise stirred the contents of her compote bowl.
"Now that you've met the inspector in person, what do you think of him?"
"I like him. He is more or less the man he ought to be, though I hadn't expected he would be so deferent to his betters. Perhaps he conducts himself in such a manner because he doesn't want it said that he forgot where he came from. Or perhaps he sincerely believes in the validity and authority of the hierarchy in which we live."
"In other words, you believe you were right in continuing the pretense that Sherlock Holmes is a man?"
"Yes."
Inspector Treddles was most respectful to Charlotte, but it was a respect that stemmed from gallantry, the kindness the strong owed to the weak, not the regard one held for an equal, and certainly not the admiration he felt for Lord Ingram, whom he clearly considered his superior.
"What about your friend, Lord Ingram?" asked Mrs. Watson. "He must know that you have no brother named Sherlock Holmes, yet he seems to have no trouble accepting your powers of reasoning."
"He's long been a victim of my powers. He's grown inured."
"I've seen him at polo matches. The ladies are always fanning themselves. Some men have that effect on women, even if they aren't classically handsome."
"Well, he's married."
Her statement sounded more like a grievance, an accusation.
"But not happily so, from what I understand."
His marriage was his greatest mistake. But now that someone who only knew him via gossip had commented on his private life, Charlotte felt obliged to defend that mistake. "Happiness has never been the goal in a society marriage.
Oh, I have long observed that. They are very much business arrangements, sometimes absolutely cold-blooded ones. But occasionally one comes across a union that has no reason to exist, except for love, and that overwhelming optimism love inspires. It's for those matches that I hold my breath. And it is when they do not succeed that my heart breaks a little, for what might have been.
Would there have been a might have been in Lord Ingram's case? If Charlotte hadn't warned him before his wedding that a perfect woman did not exist except in a man's imagination, if she hadn't pointed out that anyone who took the trouble to appear flawless must have an ulterior motive, would he have tested his wife, upon his godfather's passing, by telling her that he received only a £500 annuity, instead of the fortune stipulated in his godfather's will? For it was certain that had he told Lady Ingram the truth, she would have been overjoyed, rather than cold with disappointment and then hot with rage, blurting out that she only married a man known to have resulted from his mother's affair with a Jewish banker because of what he stood to inherit. Why else would she have sullied the bloodline of her own children? The question Charlotte asked herself concerned the weight of her own words. Had they planted the seed of doubt in his mind? Or would the same suspicions have formed by that point in the marriage, regardless of whether Charlotte had said anything years before? She took a deep breath. His children are lovely, at least. Mrs. Watson ate a piece of strawberry from the compote, chewing thoughtfully.
Have you ever been in love, Miss Holmes?
No. It would probably have been more convincing if her answer hadn't been as quick or emphatic. But Mrs. Watson only nodded slowly.
Sometimes that is a blessing, Miss Holmes. A blessing.
14. At noon the next day, a cable arrived for Charlotte, sent to 18 Upper Baker Street.
Dear Mr. and Miss Holmes, I am beyond pleased to inform you that the supply of strychnine at both Dr. Birch's and Dr. Harris's had indeed been compromised. The bottles contained no strychnine at all. We now have a case of clearly premeditated murder. Robert Treddles.
By evening, the news was all over London. The mysterious Sherlock Holmes had been vindicated, at least with regard to his suspicions concerning Mr. Harrington Sackville. Lady Shrewsbury's family still maintained strenuously that she died of natural causes, and that anything else was malicious slander. Lady Amelia's family, on the other hand, seemed stunned by this latest development. They were muted in their response.
"You should relish the moment, Miss Holmes," said Mrs. Watson the next morning.
She was in a dress of printed silk, a summery pattern of pastel paisley on a creamy background.
"For someone who has the greatest city on earth agog in wonder and speculation, you are far too contained in your reaction."
Charlotte spread a little too much butter on her roll. "I would feel better if all the hubbub had made a bigger difference to my family." Wild theories continued to abound as to what exactly linked those three deaths. Speculation continued as to the identity of Sherlock Holmes. At the same time, however, people were also wondering what connections, unknown to the general public, the Holmeses might have to Mr. Sackville. But the continued attention to the Holmeses wasn't solely responsible for Charlotte's subdued reaction. There were also Lord Ingram's dire words. Must she leave behind everything and everyone she knew for an uncertain future far away? And if she must ultimately make such a decision, did it not behoove her to make it sooner rather than later?
"Miss Holmes, you are fretting again."
The butter disappeared into the soft, spongy interior of the warm roll. Such a sight had always comforted Charlotte before.
and turned her mind blissfully empty when she bit into it. But this was her third roll this morning, and as Mrs. Watson had observed,